In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I had to check a map because I was embarrassed after our interview today. So I did, and it's true. I've never been further north in Canada than Edmonton. And this is maybe why, when I think about the electoral issues that matter to people who live in Canada's real north, I make a common mistake. I assume that the biggest issues are the ones we hear about all the way down here. And you know what they are.
Canada is warming up twice as fast as the rest of the world.
A new study says permafrost in the Canadian Arctic is melting so fast that it's swallowing the equipment scientists left there to study it.
We recognize that true reconciliation goes beyond a list of action items. What is needed is a national strategy as we continue to renew the relationship between the Crown and Indigenous peoples in Canada.
It will perhaps not shock you to learn, as I did, that life in Canada's north is just life, and it doesn't conform to the narratives that us in the media and our politicians would like it to. So it's also not wholly your fault if you didn't know the same things that I didn't know.
There's some housing, but it's not all affordable. We're short right now, as we speak, 3,100 units, and nothing good comes out of an overcrowded house.
Today, we take responsibility for the harm caused by the policies and actions of the federal government. The racism and discrimination that Inuit faced was and always will be unacceptable.
Every time you see a federal leader up in the north in a classy parka standing in front of a gorgeous vista, they're making the same mistake that I did. They are playing to the Southerners, and they are talking about the kinds of issues that we tend to think are the ones that matter to the north. And yes, the climate crisis and reconciliation matter a great deal to voters in Nunavut and in other territories. They are just not at all the only issues. They're not even the most pressing ones. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Our Lay of the Land series continues. Today, going north, you might imagine, to Iqaluit, Nunavut, where Kent Driscoll is a video journalist for APTN. Hi, Kent.
Hi.
So tell me, how's this federal election going so far for Canada's north?
Yeah, so here in Nunavut, the federal election's been really interesting. In the lead up to the federal election, the Liberals have seemingly tried to bring every single cabinet minister to Iqaluit in the lead up. We've had, in a two-week period at the end of August, beginning of September, we had seven members of cabinet and the prime minister all here at various different times. So they are really trying to use their federal outreach here to show some real boots on the ground. And the events have been well attended, and it's been mostly re-announcing previous programs, but trying to show people what they have been up to, because we haven't had a Liberal MP here for a while to tell people about that.
How normal is that in an election just prior to an election, for the government to put so many boots on the ground up there?
It has been normal recently. Leona Aglukkaq, when she was the federal member from Nunavut, she was in the federal cabinet, and Prime Minister Harper would come up with her here at least once a year. Now, he would come for the military exercises and do things on the side. Trudeau comes here and he meets more with the Inuit organizations than with the government of Nunavut. So the big difference isn't in the amount of people that's coming, it's their focus. The Liberal government seems more committed to working with these Indigenous organizations, and the Conservative preference was always to work directly with the government of Nunavut. So we're not seeing more people, it's just the focus has been a little shifted.
Is that focus, does it tend to be in proportion to the value of the number of seats in the north, or is this done primarily for Southern voters to see the Liberals up there?
Oh, it has a lot to do with southern voters. Absolutely. When you come to Nunavut as the prime minister, you look like the prime minister. You're out there on the tundra wearing some sort of casual jacket, looking enthusiastic. Harper looked like prime minister when he got off, and Trudeau does too. So a lot of it is for southern voters. When Andrew Scheer was here a couple months ago, he did a little press conference out at Sylvia Grinnell National Park or Territorial Park, and he talked with locals while he was here. But then once he went back south, the commercial he ended up putting out, it focused a lot on the southern priorities for the north. So the Northwest Passage, fighter jets, all of that stuff that, while is important to the country, isn't as important to Nunavut voters. So when Scheer was here, he absolutely did some of that.
What is important to Nunavut voters and maybe in other parts of the north as well? Not to lump them all in together. I know there's multiple issues across a huge territory.
For Nunavut voters, I just got back from Pond Inlet, Nunavut, and that's on the northeastern tip of Baffin Island. I was there for APTN National News. We're doing a series of stories. But one of the things I did, I actually spent 2 hours in front of the co-op on Sunday afternoon, just talking with people who came by, sort of word on the street thing. And the issues I kept hearing about the federal election were the same that you always hear. Housing. Nunavut needs $2 billion in funding just to get the housing stocks up to break even with our population. And the Nutrition North Food Subsidy, that was put in under the Conservatives. Then when the Liberals took over, they didn't scrap it. They decided to expand the program and change it. So Nutrition North and housing are always going to be doorstep issues here because we have a population that it's hard to find jobs. The cost of living is astronomical. I mean, start looking. Average rent in Nunavut is $2,600 a month.
Wow.
And that's for a basic two-bedroom here in Iqaluit. We have like a 2.5-bedroom for my family. We use one of them as a game room. But we're paying $3,200 a month here in Iqaluit for that 2.5-bedroom apartment.
Those are Toronto prices.
Well, that leads into that Liberal program that I heard you guys talking about on this podcast a few days ago. The cost of living for buying new homes. Iqaluit's real estate market is comparable to Vancouver or Toronto. You're not finding a detached dwelling for under $500,000. And I know already, I'm asking the Liberal candidate, is there any chance that that program can apply here in Nunavut? I'm looking forward to getting a chance to put that question to her because it would make a huge difference here in Nunavut.
Why is the housing market up there so crazy? I mean, I hadn't heard anything about it. I kind of understand why food prices have skyrocketed in the north, but I just never knew that about housing.
The housing, it's like every problem in Nunavut, it's a tapestry, right? There's a lot of different things playing in. But the cost of shipping things up to actually build those homes, the cost of getting skilled professionals up here to do the building, all of the regular factors that make doing business more expensive in Nunavut apply to the housing file. All of our housing is already overcrowded. It's hard to find that $2,600 a month apartment, even if you were willing to pay it. And so that's scarcity. And the scarcity drives up the price, especially here in the capital. But in Nunavut's more remote communities, you're looking at similar pricing.
Has any candidate addressed those issues directly? Or I guess more to the point, have any of the federal parties addressed this issue? Because again, I'm stunned that I didn't hear of this.
There was some funding for housing in the last federal budget. And when Trudeau was here recently, he was touting that. Through our work here at APTN National News, we end up dealing with the local housing authority fairly often. Terry Audlaw, their president, has told me $2 billion is how much you're looking. Just get caught up on the social side of housing. So those are people who need subsidized housing. That Liberal money that they did announce, sure, it helps, but it's literally a drop in the bucket.
So what else is driving voters up there? And again, this might be our southern bias talking, but I feel like when our leaders talk to us about affairs in the north, they're often trying to tout their credentials with the environment and Indigenous peoples.
Overall, I'd say the feedback I'm hearing from people, that is true. A major issue that you may not have noticed from a southern perch is the airline merger. We have two airlines here, or head two airlines, Canadian North and First Air. Now, they wanted to merge. Competition Bureau of Canada told the federal cabinet that that would be a monopoly and they shouldn't let it happen. Minister Garneau brought it to cabinet and they decided to go ahead with allowing the merger. They have 30 different, basically, provisions that they have to follow in order to follow through on the merger. But the merger's been allowed. Now, cost of airfare is everything here. To fly from Iqaluit to Ottawa return, you're looking at $2,200. and that's for one seat. Now imagine trying to take a family of four on vacation once a year, and that's what you're paying. So that airline merger, that's going to play out throughout the campaign, absolutely.
Is there anger towards the Liberals the same way we've seen in other provinces in Canada, that they feel that the North was promised things that weren't delivered?
From what I'm hearing from people, I think anger would be a strong word. What Nunavut voters try to do, inevitably, and this is what happened last election with the late movement of votes to Hunter Tutu, the Liberal candidate, they try and figure out who's going to make the government. Then we vote for that person from that party in order to try and access that federal funding, because 98% of Nunavut's funding comes from the federal government. So ideally, we want the territory looks and says, well, we want someone on the inside of that cabinet room who's going to lobby for us. Now, the Conservatives the last two times had Leona Glucock in there doing it, and Hunter Tutu had been chosen to cabinet before he was removed from the Liberal caucus. So I would watch seriously in this election for a last-minute shift towards one of the parties, and the Nunavut riding will try and mirror that.
That's a really interesting strategy. Are there any polls out already showing a particular candidate in the lead?
Oh, don't believe any polling data you get from Nunavut.
Really?
Oh, you've got 25 communities, you've got 25 races. Each one of these are intensely local. And plus, if you're trying to do telemarketing in Nunavut, you're going to fail. I mean, I'm a unilingual English speaker, but if someone phones me up as a telemarketer, oh, I'm unilingual inuptitude in a hurry. no one's answering phone polls. So all you've got is a good guess. Now, I listen to some people here. There are people who are experienced with the government. Former cabinet minister Ed Pico is usually within 5-10 percentage points of figuring out what's going to happen. But no, polling data from here, it's pretty hilarious, actually.
I also want to ask you about climate change, because we've heard this issue come up every time we talk to anyone from any province. Obviously, we cover it a lot on our show. But you guys are kind of on the front lines of it. Is it more of a pressing issue up there?
It's definitely a pressing issue. I had mentioned earlier, I just got back from Pond Inlet. And one of the questions I was asking people on the street, just straight out, is the climate changing? And I want to say 75, 80% of the people I talked to said, yes, absolutely. It's getting warmer in the summer, colder in the winter. There aren't as many narwhal coming through by Pond Inlet right now. And they haven't seen a seal all summer, which is that's shocking to me. Usually this time of year, if you're walking around in the street in Pond Inlet, you'll see seal skins up against houses drying all over the place. That isn't happening this summer. So in general, Inuit have acknowledged that climate change is real and it's going to start to play itself out in the election. On the other hand, the carbon tax, our conservative candidate is already running hard against that. There's a few exemptions, like they're not charging the carbon tax on aviation fuel or on fuel to generate electricity, but we're still paying more at the tank. So it's the climate change issue is going to be played out here. I don't know how wide yet.
Well, you kind of touched on my follow-up question, which is how does combating climate change look different in the North from major metropolises in Canada?
Well, it looks different because we lack the infrastructure to try and tackle it. Every power generation station in Nunavut is diesel. That's expensive and dirty, and we have to fly it in. We don't have any alternative sources of power. Now, they're building a new power plant in Kugluktuk that's going to have some solar panels on it. The municipality of Clyde River put in some solar panels themselves. But trying to stop climate change here in Nunavut, we're such a small population, and we're such big carbon users. I mean, so much of our food is flown in. That's a carbon-heavy thing. So it's the idea of Nunavumiut being able to do something about it by themselves, it's pretty much a non-starter with the way the territory is set up.
I also wanted to ask you about reconciliation, because back in 2015, the Liberals ran hard on a promise to address this, and they have done so. But every time we talk to folks about it, we get the sense that it either hasn't gone far enough or it's been seen as kind of cynical. And you would be much closer to the communities who are impacted by this.
Well, what I've been hearing, and it's there have been three federal apologies in the last year. And when Dr. Carolyn Bennett was up here most recently for the most recent apology to Inuit, I just straight out asked her, you've apologized three times. Are there any more apologies you have planned before the election? And her and PJ Akiokuk, he's the president of the QIA, that's the Regional Inuit Association for Baffin Island, their approach is Bennett's willing to apologize if it's important to the Inuit group. So it's these Inuit organizations who are pushing for these reconciliation attempts. And the apologies, when delivered, are very well received. The tuberculosis apology for the treatment of tuberculosis patients in the 70s. There wasn't a dry eye in the house when Trudeau was up speaking. The Ahiarmu apology in Arviat, it was very emotional. So on the reconciliation agenda, the apologies are working, but there's also, they deal with the Inuit organizations differently than previous governments. Every time I see a federal cabinet minister here, Nathan Obed from ITK, which is the national Inuit organization, he's there with them. Aluki Kuturik, the NTI president, that's the Inuit organization for all of Nunavut, she's there. And they're hand in hand with these Liberal cabinet ministers. So reconciliation is taking a couple of different tacks here. There's the formal apologies, and there's the working with the Inuit orgs. And people aren't cynical about it yet. There's a lot to apologize for here.
That's really interesting because, you know, down here where we're nowhere near, most of us, as close to Inuit or Indigenous communities, we kind of hear that it's all talk and no action. But what you just described sounds like that talk really matters.
For the people who were individually affected, those apologies are real. And those apologies have a real effect on people. Because, I mean, like the tuberculosis one was incredibly emotional because there were so many people sitting there in the audience who had had family members sent down south for 2, 3, 4 years, and some of them never came back. And the idea of the prime minister of the country standing there and apologizing for it meant something to those people.
What do Canadians from the south, and I know I'm speaking generally, and there are some that this won't apply to, but it applies to me probably. What should southern Canadians know about the north that we just don't really understand?
I'll quote one of the women I talked to on the street in Pond Inlet who said, let everyone know that we don't live in igloos. So that's true.
We don't
live in igloos.
Right.
That basic. It's there's so much misunderstanding about this part of the country. And it's, I know I didn't know much. I've been here 12 years and I didn't know much when I got off the plane. I've managed to listen to people and gather some up, but it's remote. Everything is a challenge. And everything is understaffed, from the schools to the government to even the RCMP have trouble recruiting here. And the other thing people need to understand about dealing with Nunavut is that every problem or challenge sort of relates into the other ones. You can't look at housing without taking a good look at the economy. You can't take a look at what the government of Nunavut is up to without taking a look at how much money they're getting federally. Every challenge is interwoven. It's a complete tapestry.
Same question then, but applied to party leaders that come up there. What don't they address that they could speak plainly to and it would make a difference for them?
What don't they address? Well, they tend to be very scripted events, right? They come in, they have their talking points, they have their speech that they want to give, and then they take some questions from the reporters. The thing that they could do that would sort of get that message across would be, I think, fewer scripted events and just genuinely talk to people. Now, some of them seem to do that. I know I mentioned Dr. Carolyn Bennett earlier. Dr. Bennett's been coming here for the last 8, 9 years. And whenever she gets off a plane, there are people here who know her. Like that sort of put the feet on the ground and you'll learn something approach is probably the best way to handle dealing with Nunavut. Not to mention, you have to listen more than you talk. That's the big thing. As a Southern reporter moving here and having been here 12 years, listen more than I talk is the best lesson I've learned.
What outcome that's possible would surprise you the most about how Nunavut and the North vote in this election?
Surprise me the most? What I'm hearing talking to people, we do have a strong three-way race here in Nunavut right now. We've got Leona Glucock, former cabinet minister for the Progressive Conservatives. Megan Pizzo-Lyle, she's a very interesting cabinet, young Inuit woman, the early 30s. She has connections in all three regions, and she's going to be a tough candidate. And then the NDP just announced their candidate, 25-year-old Mumilak Kakik. She works for NTI, that's the Territorial Inuit Organization, in their Inuit Employment Office. And she's very thoughtful and very progressive. And don't think so much about 25 being young. Nunavut has Canada's fastest growing and youngest population. 25 years old is the average age of someone in Nunavut. So I think the biggest surprise would be if someone ran away with this thing. From what I'm hearing, it's going to be a very close election here, no matter who takes it.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thank you.
Kent Driscoll is a video journalist for APTN in Iqaluit, Nunavut. And that was the big story. For more from us, including the past episodes of Lay of the Land, and there are at least 7 more to come, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, as always, we are wherever you get your podcasts. On Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on iCatcher. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.